Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Think of a song you really love.
Don't you want to know why you love it so much?
Well, we can't answer that.
No, but we can deep dive into it anyway.
Unless we get too sidetracked.
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast.
One musician.
And one psychologist.
Talking about iconic songs. The musical tricks that blow our minds.
And what they show us about our minds.
Join us each week as we pick apart everything from TLC to Weezer.
And from Billie Eilish to Bruno Mars, with plenty of distractions in between.
Check out Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Unlock a new era in podcasting with Unfiltered Studios. Ready to break free from the ordinary? Dive into a world where authenticity meets innovation. Our network isn't just about podcasts. It's a revolution. From nostalgia to movies, sports to self-improvement, find your favorite podcast in an array of diverse shows, only at Unfiltered Studios. Join the movement. Subscribe to Unfiltered Studios today and join the podcasting revolution. Unfiltered Studios, where every voice finds its place. Visit unfpod.com today to find your favorite show.
Unfiltered Studios will help you press record.
And hello, movie lovers, and welcome to the show. With me, I have my good friend Bob Clement, and we're going to be reviewing Fright Night scene by scene. We're going to talk about this nostalgically and then actually stripping away the nostalgia by going scene by scene. It's a pleasure to have Bob on the show for the very first time. I hope he comes back again. So without further ado, let's welcome Bob to the show. And hey, Bob, how are you?
Hey, how's it going? Maybe after tonight you won't want me back. I don't know. I wouldn't speak too quickly.
We also collabed on one thing, so you don't need to come back. We're good.
Okay. But no, I mean, no, this will be great. Yeah, we were on the other thing, so it went well there. So
exactly. We already got the intro done. We're good.
Yeah, everything went well.
If you can, just tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your podcast, and then we'll get on with the trivia, and then from the trivia, we'll go on with the nostalgia rating.
Okay. So, Bob Lament, I have a show called Static Radio. We've been on for a while, staticradio.com, if you feel like checking it out. And each week, we tell stories, mostly. Hopefully funny stories. If not funny, hopefully weird. And we try to lighten everybody's load each week. That's about it.
Okay. Well, my question for you, though, is, when you look at nostalgia, when you look at the nostalgia rating for it out of 10, where do you rank this at? What was the first time you've seen the movie Fright Night?
Well, you're going to laugh. I think the last time I saw it, I can't remember the first time I saw it. Last time I saw it, it was on VHS. So I'd never watched this on DVD or anything like that. I watched it on VHS. And so it has a very high nostalgia rating for me. Because I vaguely remember it, but I don't exactly remember when I saw it. It's been long enough ago to where I can't recall, but I know I have not watched it. I know I watched it sometime in the era of VHS, which has been quite a while ago now.
You know what? I'm going to say the same thing for me, though, as well. Like, I remember watching this on cable, on DirecTV for the first time, and enjoying it. And then every single time whenever it comes on, I just feel like I have to watch it. It doesn't matter when or what I'm doing. It's like, okay, Fright Night's on. I got to watch this movie. Regardless of the fact it's Halloween or not Halloween, I have to watch this movie. And then also, too, it has this little secret window kind of vibe, Albert Hitchcock kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
With the kid looking out the window, wondering if his neighbor's a vampire or stuff like that. It's kind of like one of those old children's stories that I would read. And wondering if your neighbor's a vampire or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That was great, though. You're right. Hitchcock. And it definitely, especially at the beginning, I don't know how far we're going to get into this, but it had a Hitchcock feel to it right out of the gate.
Exactly. Yeah. And this movie is fast-paced. I remember this movie not being so fast.
Yeah, the pace is great. I mean, if you think about it, what is this, 85?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it holds up. It wasn't slow. Like a lot of times if you watch movies, you know, for older movies, the pacing is always a little slower. And this one, everything kept moving. I mean, it was just zip, 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 move the story along. Didn't have a lot of wasted, you know, storylines that like on each character. It was basically the main story and we ran right through it. And I liked it. I mean, I liked that aspect of it, is because it wasn't bogged down by saying, you know, let's follow this character for a while and get some of their backstory. Let's follow this character. And then let's see what the pharmacist is doing or something.
And, right, exactly.
Which is all a waste of time, where this is what, and I can't remember the running time on it off the top of my head, but I mean, this is what like a 90-minute, you know, 100-minute movie should be. Very quick, exactly. To the point, get you through, entertain you the whole time. So
right. It's only an hour and 42 minutes long, which is perfect for an 80s movie like this, you know? And like you said, mostly nowadays it's like a 2.5-hour movie where they want to go on and give backstory on every single character. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you get into the plot because they have to sell you on these characters. This story, basically, it's just one of those movies that have no layers or anything like that to these characters. Mm-hmm. They are who they are.
There's one character that has layers, but it's not necessarily the main character.
Which one would you say actually have layers? I'm just wondering.
Well, Peter Vincent, of course.
Right, Peter Vincent.
He's the movie host, and right. I think they did an incredible job of giving you his backstory without telling you his backstory.
Right. And I always say less is more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it was fantastic the way they did it. And you don't really meet him until, gosh, at least a half an hour or so in the movie. But you see him on the television multiple times. And he's not telling you about himself, but he's doing his gig, right? Which was a horror movie host. But he's doing horror movies about horror movies that he was in. And so all of a sudden now you've got this deep backstory on this character with just these little, like, you know, 30-second, 45-second clips that play in the background on the TV, sometimes just being panned across while other things are happening in the scene. And, I mean, I thought that was genius. I mean, you'll get that today a lot of times. It's so ham-fisted. And they want you to know about these characters, where they would just, you know, do a time thing where they're like, go back in time when he's shooting the movie. And then, you know, he's a jerk, and then he loses his cachet. And then, you know, it would be like a whole thing with him. If we had a modern day kind of a situation where,
right. And then he goes like, back into the modern day. Right.
Yeah. That he's a secondary character, even though he's, you know, obviously Charlie is our primary character. He's us. Right.
Right.
And we're looking out the window, wondering about the neighbor and what's going on over there. And then his girlfriend and Peter Vincent are secondary characters. Right. And Evil Ed. But it's not like that they made, you know, more room for him, Peter Vincent, to be in there just because. And at the time, Roddy McDowall, who plays him, he's still a viable mainstream actor at that time. Exactly. A lot of people won't know him now, but at the time this was made, he was older, but he still, I mean, he had a fantastic career and was a name, you know. He opened movies. Most of them called Planet of the Apes, but he did.
That's true. That's very true. But, you know, for my nostalgic rating, I'm going to have to go at least an 8 out of 10 for me. Because of the simple fact of the nostalgia that just puts me there, like you mentioned, with the whole entire deal of us being like Charlie looking through the window, wondering if the neighbor's a vampire or not, what's going on with that, And then also, too, we want to make out with our girlfriends and stuff like that, too, when we're teenagers. And hopefully we get lucky. So, you know, I like that little element of an innocence of this kid that's looking through the window and wondering what's going on while also trying to figure everything else out. So I definitely like that.
And you mentioned fooling around with his girlfriend. This is such an 80s movie.
Uh-huh.
And you know, because it's a different time, right? You don't get this the same way. So, you know, the funny thing is you have this, again, you think about layers. So he's infatuated with what's going on next door, the vampire. But he also wants to, you know, make it with his girlfriend. And that's at the very beginning of the movie. And that's an 80s movie, right? I mean, it's a teenage, you know, sex comedy type thing for the 80s that happened over and over and over again. And you really, I mean, they do have those today, but not in the same way, if that makes sense.
It does.
It really is of its time, you know?
Right. And we're going to get into the scene by scene in a minute, but I just want to go on ahead and talk about a little bit of the trivia, and then after that, we'll get into the whole scene by scene. So, let's see here. So, the development of the film, while writing the script for Cloak and Dagger, Tom Holland amused himself when he convinced the idea of a horror movie fan becoming convinced that the next-door neighbor was a vampire, but he did not initially think this premise was enough to sustain a story. And he's like, what's he going to do? Holland asked. Because everybody's going to think he's mad. The story's prolated into his mind for a year. And finally, one day, while discussing it with John Byers, then the head of the story development at Columbia Pictures, he finally figured out what the boy would do. Of course, he's going to go to Vincent Price in that era. Many local TV stations in the United States had horror hosts such as Zach Early, and then you also have
Sven Gulli.
Yep, Sven Gulli in the nationally as an Elvira, of course. How can we ever forget the Queen Shiva? You know, because that was my crush. That was my gothic crush.
Everybody had a crush on Elvira. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so Holland decided it would be natural for the boy to seek aid from his local host. The minute I had Peter Vincent, I had the story. Charlie Brodery was the engine, but Peter Vincent was the heart, like you mentioned. Once he'd convinced that character, Holland knocked out the first draft of the script in 3 weeks, and I was laughing the entire time, literally on the floor, knocking my feet in the air in hysteria. So that's just a little bit of the trivia that I found interesting with it. And so, with that being said, we're now going to go on ahead and go into the scene by scene, breaking this thing down. And we're going to do that right now. So, it opens up. And I love how this movie opens up right off the bat with this. So, we have Charlie Brodery is a teenage fan of horror films. He stays up late at night to watch the horror movie TV series Fright Night, hosted by actor Peter Vincent, played by Roddy McDowall, who played a vampire hunter for many years in horror movies. One night, while he's in his room with his girlfriend, Amy Peterson, he sees two new neighbors moving in next door, and they appear to be carrying what looks like a coffin. After he learns that a young woman who went to the neighbor's house had been murdered, he begins to spy on them until he sees one of them, Jerry Dinbridge, baring his fangs to bite a woman's neck. So the opening scene, I really loved how they opened it up to that, where we have like a little bit of a mystery element of this neighbor moving next door. We don't know what's going on, just like how Charlie does not know what's going on or anything like that. And it looks like a body. We don't know it's a body or anything. And then he's also trying to get lucky with his girlfriend too, because they get into an argument, remember? Right. And he's like, well, are you going to give me any or not? Because I'm every single time it's like, no, Charlie, I'm not in the mood, Charlie. No. And I'm like, at this moment, I didn't realize that the hero of this film was such a ball bag. Because now as an adult, I'm like, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, this dude needs to be punched in the face. He's the most punchable face for me at this moment. Yeah. And
hey, but that was the 80s. That was the 80s, man.
Yeah, it's the 80s. I get it. I get it. But yeah, just looking through adult lenses, like stripping away the nostalgia of it, I'm like, yeah, I was that kid, but I would actually punch me in the face.
Well, a weird piece of trivia is that, and I didn't even realize this until I watched it this last time, because I haven't watched it in quite a while. I just watched it a couple nights ago, is his girlfriend is Amanda Beers. Mm-hmm. And her fame came later because she was the neighbor in Married with Children.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm like, I didn't even realize it. And I'd seen this thing before, and it didn't even dawn on me until I was watching this last time. I'm like, wait a minute. That's Marcy Darcy.
And you know what's funny? My wife just noticed that, though, today when we were watching it again, because I had to do, because I always do a rewatch before the review. And she's like, I said, you do know who that is, right? She goes, no. I said, that's the next door neighbor from Married with Children. She goes, oh, I didn't even recognize her. That was almost, that has to be like way before she got discovered on Married with Children. I said, yeah, it's way before that.
Only about 4 or 5 years, I think. 4 years, maybe.
Not bad.
Yeah. The other funny thing is that they, all these people, the kids were in their mid-20s and they're playing high schoolers, but that's a, that's typical of an 80s movie as well.
Yeah, it's typical in 80s, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's, but, you know, what did you think of the whole deal of, like, when you first see the, see maybe a body bag and stuff like that? And what did you think of that aspect?
Well, I love the intro because it was very Hitchcockian, right? So the camera, we are the camera and we follow all this that's going on. And essentially we're Charlie then too. The camera comes in and then we become Charlie. And it was really a good introduction into his character. You know, he's a typical 80s horny teenager, but this, what's going on next door is more interesting. And it catches his, you know, eye, and he's like, what the heck is going on, right? And we didn't mention it, but Jerry Dandridge, Chris Sarandon did such a good job of being the neighbor, and he evoked, I think, all, he was the 80s version of Dracula.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Christopher Lee, who actually was on the television briefly at certain points, was Dracula back in the 60s for the Hammer horror films. And then Frank Langella was Dracula in the 70s. And they both look, he looks like both of those people. And has this very dark, mysterious. And I was watching it, I watched it with my wife. And she goes, you know, Chris Sarandon was really good looking. That's what she said. And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. Because this would have been at the height of his, you know, kind of the height of his career and his, you know, age and so forth. He was probably in his like early 30s or 30 or something like that. And he was a very charismatic person, and they picked the right person to be in that role. And he was funny and he was charming and everything that he should have been in that role. And he went on to be in The Princess Bride and did a great job in that as well. But him coming in, and I another little piece of weirdness to that is when they were carrying the coffin in, his assistant had two hands on the coffin and he had one because he's so strong, right?
Right, exactly.
He's very,
but at that point, it's like, look, you can just carry your own crap. That's what I'd be like. I said, look, clearly you don't need my help. Okay.
No.
You just need me to go on ahead, block the sun out in the basement. Mm-hmm. I got you on there. Okay. Just call me in the morning. Just let me know when you're going to sleep, and I'll go on ahead and darken the basement up. Right. And then after that, you can go on ahead and go to sleep while I do all the work.
Right. Yep. But it really drew you into the movie, though. That just, and I mean, I can't remember how long that scene was, but it couldn't have been more than, you know, a few minutes.
It's only like maybe 5 minutes into the film, basically, if you think about it like this, between Charlie and his girlfriend arguing. Mm-hmm. And then finally she's like, yeah, we'll go on ahead. I'll sleep with you. I want you.
He goes, right, that's you right. Sure? You just turn me down. Yeah, I'll do it. Next thing you know it, something interrupts him, which is them moving next door and seeing the coffin mm-hmm. and stuff. And you're right. It's like, you know, it's totally different after that. And it's a whole entire introduction into that lens changes the whole entire perspective of everything that Charlie ever knew. And I've liked how it draws you in. Like, it lasts some 5 minutes and you're hooked into it. It has a hook and it allows you to actually see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it knows its identity. It knows what it wants to be. And it allows you to do that. And then I like how after that happens, they go back downstairs and the mother goes, oh, are you guys okay? I heard a little bit I heard you guys arguing. Oh, yeah, we're fine. We just argued a little bit. It's all good. I don't want you to have to not get married. I'm like, what? I'm like, you guys are, look, lady, look, they were about to actually have a, you were about to be a grandparent upstairs.
Okay. Well, I won't tell you, say why, but just make a note. So in that scene at the beginning, where were they in relation to in the room? Where were they at? Do you remember?
They were in the living room. Yeah.
No, I mean in his bedroom.
They were in his bedroom. Yeah.
On the floor. Keep that in mind for later.
Okay.
They were fooling around on the floor beside his bed, when we get later in the movie, there'll be a reason I mention that.
Okay. Because I'm kind of curious now about that. Because
I don't want to get too much away. We're moving through the movie, so.
Right, exactly. But I just thought that was kind of funny, though, is like, ooh, that's kind of cringy because your mom is already talking about marriage and you're not even thinking about that. You just want to go on ahead and get some and move on with your life.
Get it on. But I think that, again, that's just the time, right? So the times were, that was, you know.
Right.
It's almost like the 50s or something. You think about in the 80s now, it seems... The funny thing is it's more risque than today and more tame all at the same time, which is weird because I'm trying to think. There wasn't any nudity per se in the movie that I can recall, but in the 80s there was a little bit. Oh, no, yeah, the neighbor, right. His neighbor.
Yeah.
Nudity. Yes, that's right.
And then there were some suggestive things inside the club. But
this is a PG movie.
No, it's not. It's rated R. Believe it or not, it's rated R.
Okay. But in the 80s, it wouldn't be out of line for a PG movie to have nudity. So, I mean, this all falls in line, right?
Right, exactly. Because,
yeah.
Now that you mention it, think of the Ronnie Dangerfield movie, Back to School.
Right.
That was a PG movie and it had boobs in it. It had nudity.
I think the only reason that this one probably became R was because of cursing. Not because of the nudity.
No,
so yeah, like the neighbor had the woman and had her shirt off. That's right. But I think that was the only time, wasn't it?
I believe so. That was like the only time that you've seen any kind of nudity or anything.
But it was at the beginning, so it really pulled you into the movie. Made you pay attention. Hey, look.
Exactly. It's like, I'm up here, not down here. You need to focus on what's going on.
Here, yeah.
Right.
And then there was the woman out front who was looking very scantily clad and so forth, but she didn't show anything as far as I recall. But yeah, the one in the bedroom with the Jerry Dandridge, she showed her top was off.
But another thing though too is like, I know that we mentioned the whole Alfred Hitchcock kind of feel to it, but even the opening title of Fright Night even feels like an Alfred Hitchcock thing because it doesn't even show any type of credits or anything. It just goes straight into it saying Fright Night.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely has that Alfred Hitchcock kind of feel to it.
Yeah, and then the teeth come out, which was a nice touch.
It was.
Yeah, very nice touch so there's no ambiguity in what you're going to see. You're going to see a vampire movie because the teeth came out of the words Fright Night.
Exactly. That's very settled. It does not even, you don't even need to see a vampire. You already know what you're getting.
That's right.
You haven't seen this movie yet. But... So before we actually get into the part with the next door neighbor, they wind up going into the diner where Evil is working.
Mm-hmm.
And that's whenever you notice on the TV set that there's somebody else that died besides the woman that, you know, that he wound up seeing that same night. But I like how, you know, you have his girlfriend coming in there apologizing to him for last night. She goes, look, I'm so sorry. That was my fault. I'm like, what? This girl's apologizing for something that Charlie did? I'm like, dude, you need to keep her? Because it's rare that you're going to find
somebody. She's already trained. No, I'm just joking.
Right. But the thing is, and then after that, it goes into the news thing, and he chews her out yet again, and this time right. She shoves a hamburger in his face.
Right. She gets mad at him for ignoring her. And that brings up a good point with the use of the television. So nowadays, you get the text on the screen to show people are texting to each other, right? That's kind of a trope in movies nowadays. They really utilize the television in a good way to bring the move the story forward. There was another murder last night, you know, and then we also see Peter Vincent's show, and all this is happening. It's not a character that comes in and says, "Guess what, Charlie? Somebody else died." You know, they do it almost subliminally in a way by using the television as the mechanism to give this information rather than having another character, you know, constantly interjecting, which was nice.
It was nice to do that for a change. And I like you said, I like how they utilized the TV set as a way to get your news, because that's the only way to get the news at that time.
Right. Exactly.
Well, and everybody's watching the same station, so everybody's going to pick up the same news story.
There's only four, maybe. Right.
So, you know, and also, too, I like how, you know, now in today's time, like you said, social media, stuff like that, it's going to cover it before anything else. Mm-hmm. So I like how I like getting the news from the source that way, because that's how I was brought up. Yeah. But, you know, I definitely like that. But the whole entire introduction to Evil, I found him annoying this time. I just found his character very annoying, especially that laugh he does. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Right. I'm like, you know what, Charlie? You get a pass from me with most punchable face for now. Because
I think, though, again, this is a product of its time, because the guy who played Evil Ed was in a lot of the teenage comedy movies back then. I think he was in Fraternity Vacation before this, which is a real, with Tim Robbins of all people, which is, you know, more, definitely more of like a sex romp kind of thing. And he's kind of like an 80s comic relief. And he is annoying, and it was annoying. And even back then, there probably was an annoyance factor, but it was tempered by the fact that every movie had an Evil Ed.
That's true.
And so you were used to it. You know what I mean? You're almost, you know, it's probably
like a character trope. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Total character trope. And he, you know, he was overdoing it. And he was the weak part to the movie. I think everybody else, as far as the main characters go, with Charlie and Amy and Peter Vincent and Jerry, the vampire, and even his assistant, to some extent, he was probably the second most annoying, but Evil Ed didn't fit in, you know, upon repeated viewing. At the time, you probably let it slide because of the nature of things, but now you're right, very grating.
Right, it definitely is. But, you know, this is actually fun about stripping away the nostalgia and seeing how we feel about it as adults compared to how we were as kids. So that's what I have fun at, you know. But
when you're a kid, you probably thought Evil Ed was the best character,
right? I don't remember him being this annoying as a kid.
Right,
like, as a kid, I'm laughing at his jokes. I'm like, oh, Evil Ed is so damn funny. He's hilarious. He needs his own movie. No, I didn't go that far, but I was just saying that his character for me worked. And then now as an adult, I'm like, this kid's annoying. I would like to actually use duct tape if I could.
Yeah, I mean, he does have some other things coming up in the movie, but yeah, if they would have got rid of him as a character, not a great loss.
No, definitely not. And there's also something else I want to talk about later on with his character and stuff too, especially when he makes the deal with Jerry. Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. But I like also too where now he's suspecting that there's a vampire next door, because he sees, of course, the girl undressing. And he's, and the guy, and Jerry winds up biting into her neck. The next night, he's sworn to protect his mom from not even entering the house. Because remember, he goes to Evil Ed. He goes, what do I do? There's a vampire next door. He goes, okay, you need holy water, you need a wooden stake, and you also need a cross. And he gives him the whole entire vampire lore.
Right.
And I thought to myself, well, you watch Denson, why do you need evil to tell you what the hell to do when you watch Benson?
Yeah.
I guess it's the fact, too, that he's the closest person to him, and there's no way to reach out to Benson. So it's like, well, I'm going to reach out to the other person that I know that's close to me that might be able to help me with this. But evil is probably thinking, okay, he's just talking out of his ass. There's no way that there's a vampire that's near him. Because he even laughs at him as he leaves. He goes, okay, good luck on your vampire outing.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and you're right. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, other than maybe just self-doubt and that's your sounding board. You're right. They did, again, if Evil Ed went away, we'd still come to the same conclusion. So,
exactly. Because I feel like he doesn't need Evil Ed to give him that stop or anything.
Right.
Because he already knows what to do. But it's the whole the real factor of, oh, there's a vampire next door to me. I gotta do something. But yeah. Then there's a little bit of a Lost Boys kind of feel to it, too. Because remember when Max comes over and the boys are doing all this stuff to Max.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also probably where they stole the idea for some of the stuff that they had. But, you know, but I liked how... Now you have Jerry sitting in the chair. You see this long hand that's tapping the back of the chair.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see his face, but you already know this is not going to be good. This is not going to be good for Charlie.
Right. Because
now the mother invited him in, and of course Evil tells him, look, you do not need to invite a vampire into your house or anything. Mm-hmm. And Charlie's okay, it's all good. I don't have to worry about that. All I got to do is make sure that I bolt the window to where they can't tap on my window and also hypnotize me. I'm good to go. And then you wind up having that whole entire scene where the mother's like, oh, this is our next door neighbor Jerry.
That's right. Well, and you know, you talk about the nostalgia thing, which is, I don't know if this is nostalgia, but this gets back to the 80s, and we don't ever see who Charlie's father is. I know this is going to be reading a little bit into the movie a little bit more than maybe is there, but you only see his mother. We assume that she's a single mother because the father is never mentioned and not even talked about. And because Charlie is so protective of his mother at this point, right?
Right.
And mentions it, right? And so, you know, divorce was fairly prevalent back then. And a lot of people, kids were dealing with divorce. And so that set that up really nicely. And they didn't dwell on it. And they didn't even really talk about it. But you can infer all that just from what was going on. Maybe there was other parts of the script that got cut that talked more about that. But that gives you the reason why he's a little more overprotective, maybe the reason why he's a little more paranoid. And all this kind of goes together because of the nature of the times where there was a lot of divorce back then and a lot of single parenting. And I found it, but again, Chris Sarandon, so freaking charming in those scenes with the mother, right?
She definitely has that motherly feel to her. That's what I like about her.
He played it really, really well. And, you know, at this point as the audience, we already know that he's the bad guy. But so smooth, you know, and the mom.
He plays such a great friendly neighbor. Mm-hmm. Just like, yeah, and I'm going to make sure that I come by every so often. Of course, it's okay with your mother. If it's okay with your mother, I'm like, and the mother's like, yeah, that's perfectly fine. Yeah, as long as you look, as long as he looks like the way Jerry looks, she's perfectly fine.
Sure. Nice looking guy, come over once in a while, you know.
Right.
Who knows where your dad is, Charlie? He left me.
Exactly. And I'm not worried about your dad right now. Jerry's here.
Yeah.
Jerry's now your new dad.
But that was good for the movie, though, because all that worked for the movie because it made the mom very believable to do that. You know, being a nice person, let alone, you know, having a real super charming neighbor come over. And obviously she's, you know, just a single mom trying to make it. You know, it really worked for the movie with all that going on. Yeah.
And then you have, after that happens, you're thinking that's the end of that. You know, it's like, okay, I just suffered through my whole, that whole entire 20 minutes of talking to Jerry. I'm good to go. I'm fine now. And then you realize I'm not good, because now it's late at night. The mom's already asleep. And then Jerry enters the house.
Right. Yeah. Scarily. And, yeah.
Yeah. He enters the house. You have this whole entire upstairs, downstairs scenario. Charlie goes downstairs to look. There's actually something scraping against the, you know, this cliche horror, you know, in the 80s, where basically the wind's blowing and then you see a twig banging up against the window.
Yeah.
And then you have Jerry that's destroying the, basically, the door frame to where the mother can't get out of her room. And then finally he goes in his closet, Jerry, and then of course Charlie goes back up to his room. And he's like, okay, everything is fine. Then Jerry pops out of the closet while he's looking out the window, because he ends up seeing, the light shut off.
Right, right.
And so at that point, he's like, okay, maybe I'm okay, because now everybody's gone to bed. And then Jerry comes out and he goes, look, I'm going to give you an option here that I never had before. Either you can choose to forget about me and forget about this even happened, or I go on ahead and take your life. Your choice.
Right. Yeah.
And at that point, he picks the cross and does this. I'm like, dude, he's giving you an option here. I would have took option A instead of option B. I'm like, look, you can do whatever the hell you want. I'm done. Just don't come over near my house. You stay over there. I'll stay over here. You do whatever you want to do. I'll even paint up my own window black so I don't have to see what's going on.
Well, that would have been a short movie then. Only been about 25 minutes.
That's what I call like a short horror film.
That's right. Oh, yeah. A Vampire Next Door. Yeah. You just stay over there for eternity, and then I'll live out my life here.
Right. You stay over here. I'll see you here.
You don't follow up every year, you know, on Charlie's progress. I should do
that. But yeah.
It's funny, but then they, you know, get into a scuffle, and a lot of stuff happens that, you know, this is where, you know, you're already in suspending disbelief because it's a vampire movie, and then now you have people getting thrown around the room, and the mom's, you know, pretty much, then she finally realizes they can't get out of the room and so forth. Anyway, that whole scene was a little bit on the edge there. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, but they could have played that a little bit better, a little too close together, her room and his room and all the noise and whatnot. So,
well, not only that, okay, she gets in, once Jerry is gone again, she comes into his room, right?
Right.
He's got thrown, you said scuffle? He got thrown into his own closet.
Yeah, thrown in his closet, thrown against the wall, yeah.
And she goes into his room, she doesn't even notice the closet.
Yeah.
She goes, Charlie, everything okay? Yeah, Mom, I had a nightmare. Yeah. Like, what nightmare?
I'm like, he got nails sticking out of his window. Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
I'm like, look, I can understand doing disbelief, but woman, your son got thrown into a closet, and the closet is also disarray.
Right. Yeah.
What the hell did he do? Did he sleep in his walk and destroy shit while he?
Yeah. Well, she's got other problems. She's got to get a new man. You know, this house, she can only pay for so much. I mean, maybe she got the house in the divorce settlement, but got to have upkeep.
She's got 99 problems, but Charlie ain't one.
That's right. Charlie's not one. He's almost out of there. She's trying to marry him off to Amy, for Christ's sake.
At age 17, right.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, after that happens, then we have Charlie trying to telling Amy, hey, look, Jerry's a vampire and he's living next door, and they think he's just gone crazy off the deep end. But what did you think of that scene?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, I thought that it was typical, because you have to get everybody on board, right? Which is, you can't have it just happen like that. You know, it has to have some a little bit more to it. And so he's really, you know, trying to convince them. And of course, no one's believing him, because it was set. I don't know if you know, they didn't overtly tell you where it was set, but it was set in Iowa somewhere, because he had a coffee mug. Whenever he's getting thrown around, I think it was, he's got a coffee mug with the University of Iowa logo on it, right?
Yeah, it's in the logo.
Yeah, hawk, right? So there was a couple other things I think in there that were, you know, to be, you know, small town America. So he was somewhere in Iowa. And so in Iowa, you don't have vampires. Now, they didn't play it up too much, but it was very subtle. And just the look of everything was very small town America. And it wasn't, you know, a brownstone in New York or palm trees in LA. So, you know, it was middle America. And so, yeah, you can't come into that. And oddly enough, I think that the Peter Vincent character plays into that as well. It was a little nostalgic for its time, because in middle America there was Svengoolie and Zachary and so forth, but there was these guys in every market, right? So when I was really little, there was a guy called Dr. Terror was our guy like that, and he was the news director, and then on the weekends he would pre-tape the intros and everything to the horror movie that played on Friday or Saturday night. But he was the news director, and then he put on makeup and stuff and was this character called Dr. Terror. And that was all through the Midwest. I grew up in the Midwest. So
okay,
that was all through the Midwest. And so there was all these little horror, you know, horror characters. The ones you mentioned were, like Svengoolie is Chicago and Zachary is in, I think, Ohio, Cleveland, I think. And then obviously Elvira was a nationwide kind of thing in the 80s, but she was the tail end of all that, right? So she kind of took up the mantle, because all the little ones kind of just went away. And but that all plays into this kind of small town business and trying to convince people in a small town that something is actually happening is always hard, right? You see it in classic movies, The Blob, and, you know, and all this stuff, all same kind of thing. So it's a bit of a trope, right? That you got to convince everybody that something's happening. And, you know, I mean, you're going with it at this point. If you're watching and you get hooked by that first part, you're going with it.
Exactly.
And, you know, it was a little much, but it's better than, you know, they do a swish pan and they're all suited up with the stakes on bandoleros and everything. So
exactly, like the, like James Wood and vampires, right?
Right.
But I definitely like the setup of the fact that, you know, nobody believes him in this town or anything like that. It's like this town doesn't want to believe anything. In matter of fact, I talked about this in Shaun of the Dead last year whenever I reviewed it, because my friend Tamika and I were talking about this even in Night of the Living Dead as well. We talked about this, like, would we actually pay attention enough to know if there's a zombie happening in our own area? Mm-hmm. Because we'll just be continuing on like everyday life, even half.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if a vampire was happening to live in our own neighborhood, would we even notice anything in our own? Because number one, we're glued to our phones. Number two, we're distracted way too much to even notice. So we're just going day by day with our normal life. Even notice anything go around us. Well, so it's the same kind of scenario with a small town.
The equivalent would be a serial killer. So BTK was a serial killer in Wichita, Kansas, and people knew the guy. And then whenever I found out that he was the killer, they're all like, oh yeah, he was a quiet neighbor. He went to church. He led the church group. That's the same kind of reaction that they would have in this movie. Oh, well, he just flips houses or whatever. You know, he's just fixing up that house. Why? He's such a nice guy. I mean, you'll see him during the day, but whatever.
Right. But in desperation, he calls the police. But when he reveals his suspicions to them, they believe he's pranking them and ignores his claims. That night, Charlie gets a visit from Jerry, like we said, himself, with Officer Charlie, who offers Charlie a choice. Forget about me and I'll forget about you. Charlie tries to use his crucifix. Okay, we covered all that. Then Jerry hands with enraged. Oh yeah, that's right. Charlie winds up stabbing Jerry with a pencil. He goes off and cries out back over to his house. Looks at him angrily in the window, and then Charlie's car and tears up Charlie's car in retaliation and warns Charlie that he plans to do much worse to him later. That's also another thing. The mother didn't even pay attention to his own car got wrecked outside.
Yeah, and he had a nice car, really. I mean, they had it all bondoed up and everything, but he had a Mustang Fastback. Come on, get out of town. Who wouldn't love to have that car?
I would. I would definitely like it. But I learned one thing. If you have a nice Mustang or a nice sports car, good luck. You're not going to – that car's going to get tore up.
That's true. I thought it was ingenious to use the pencil. Because the pencil is wood, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was, and then you're talking about him being in high school and so forth. And the pencil is just another one of those weird, you know, kind of inspired things that that they did, which, you know, you would always say, well, they got to get a stake. No, no. He had some pencils there. Boom, hits him with the pencil. And it got a reaction because the pencil has wood. And so, you know, you don't, it's not something that has happened normally in vampire movies. And so they really did take, you know, it seriously when they were thinking about it to say, what would a teenager have available that would be effective? You know, a pencil.
Exactly. And I was also thinking the same thing too. It's like making a joke at the vampire because he actually gets, because that's what kills him. It's like, it's wood. Mm-hmm. So he basically just stabbed him with like a mini steak.
Right, mini steak, exactly.
That's all it is. It's like a little small mini steak, and he got a flesh wound.
I can't remember what type of pencil it was. I wish I would have paid attention. Because, you know,
it has to be a number
pencil.
Two. A number two has to do that much. Wait,
yeah, what brand, though? You know, that's
maybe an Eagle. I think an Eagle would do it.
An Eagle? Okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna say Eagle.
I'm gonna go look and look closely at that and see what. What kind of pencil it was.
Another thing Charlie does, though, that I think that's stupid, like before those events even happen, too, he actually goes over to the. I'm like, dude, you're going next door. You're trespassing on those guys.
Right.
Lawn. You're looking into his basement for crying
right.
out loud.
Yeah.
And you're not thinking that there's going to be repercussions.
He's a dumb teenager. That's what teenagers do, right? Don't you have reflections upon really, really stupid things that you've done? So.
Yeah, but not
to follow suit a bit. Thank goodness, yeah. You survived, so you're good.
Well, the only stupid thing I can say is probably just broke my neighbor's window on an accident or something. But doing something stupid. That's about it.
Oh. Man, you had a very uneventful life.
Well, that and maybe a couple of other stupid events that I've done that I'm not going to bring up.
Yeah, I know.
Like, just... right, I don't get with that. But yeah, that's pretty much the gist of that scene. And then, you know, I'm just thinking, okay, so you're just asking for trouble if you're trespassing and doing all that.
Yeah, he can't give it up. He's obsessed.
Right. And you know what? I know that we talked about Albert Hitchcock's Rear Window. And then also, too, we also have another film called Disturbia that was also this same kind of way with Shia LaBeouf as well, that has that layer to it as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that one or not.
I can't recall much of Disturbia in my head right now, but I think I have seen it. Rear Window, I actually watched not too long ago because I just end up watching it every couple of years because I love that movie so much.
Nice.
But, yeah, because Jimmy Stewart gets totally infatuated with what's going on in the courtyard, and then stuff happens. But yeah, and it very, very much parallels that. This movie actually parallels a lot of movies, but puts enough of a twist on them, I think, to make it fresh for the time period. You know, you think about Rear Window, you think about just kind of the goofy comedies of the day. I mean, and then the whole vampire trope, it puts an 80s spin on it, which, you know, there's been tons of vampire movies. So Lost Boys is another one that puts a very 80s twist on vampires.
I love Lost Boys.
Yeah. but Lost Boys, so the difference I think between Lost Boys and this is Lost Boys is very, very serious in the story that it's trying to tell, much more of a serious tone, whereas this one, it's serious but not overly serious, if you can say that. It's not really a comedy, but it's certainly skews toward comedy more than, I mean, Lost Boys has some comedic elements, but it's a dark, it seems to be a darker film than this one. Although, as we progress through this, it gets pretty dark.
Yeah, it does. So now Charlie has to turn to Peter Vincent, who, after a long and Medicare career, has become clinical and dispirited for help. But the actor dismisses Charlie as an obsessed fan. Amy and Ed fear for Charlie's sanity to Ed, so they ask Vincent to prove that Jerry is not a vampire by having him insist what they claim holy water, but it turns out to be tap water. Jerry having claimed to Peter that ingesting actual holy water would be against his religious convictions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But my thing with that was, and once again, it reminds me of Lost Boys, especially with all the stuff that they did with Max and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the tap water thing, I thought it was kind of a smart move. Like, oh my God, so it does. So the legends are not true. You know, like, right. I can just imagine, like, 14-year-old me would be like, oh, he can drink that and it's holy water. This guy's right. indestructible. This vampire's indestructible. And then you find out it's just tap.
Right. Okay. Well, and still at this point, Peter Vincent is, he's basically for hire, right? They're going to pay him. Amy offers him money to do this. And so he's just trying to get paid, right? Because he's kind of a down on your luck old actor who's just lost his job doing the late night movies. And, you know, $500 is $500, man. And so he's going through the motions and thinks it's all just kind of a, you know, silly thing, but hey, for $500, I'll do that. What I found interesting about the Peter Vincent character is that he had all his props.
Right. So he still had his ready to go. Like, yeah, for someone that didn't believe in vampires and was just staging, it looked like he was Van Helsing getting ready to go ahead and take down vampires.
But it fit because that was props from his acting days and also props for his show. And so it wasn't like out of nowhere he pulls these things. He has these things because they show them in the clips on the television earlier before we actually meet him in person.
I wonder if there's like a vampire convention that he just goes to and just carries all his stuff just in case he needs it.
Well, the convention circuit, like now we have Comic-Cons, you know, at the Wazoo. But back then there was a convention circuit, but it was few and far between, comparatively speaking, I think. Because I know I watched a thing on Star Trek, and the Star Trek conventions didn't start until in the 70s, right? And so that's the same kind of thing. And so I think these old television stars, you know, were around that time too, when those things kind of kicked up because of the success of these Star Trek conventions. And, you know, cosplaying and stuff really didn't take off until later, so... you know, that's a whole other thing. But interesting thing about Peter Vincent's name that I read, and I kind of thought about it whenever I was watching it, but his name is built off of two Hammer horror icons, which is Peter Cushing and Vincent Price.
Right.
And so they took the first names and put it together to be Peter Vincent. As the character's name, because of the, you know, and at that time, Vincent Price was actually, when did Thriller happen? Michael Jackson, he did the voiceover for Thriller, when Michael Jackson turns into a zombie and everything, and was actually quite active. Edward Scissorhands, he was the old man in Edward Scissorhands. So he was actually still quite a viable, commodity even then.
That was in 83 for Thriller.
Yeah. So Vincent Price, I think they, what I read some stuff on was they approached Vincent Price and I don't think he wanted to do it. And then they went to Roddy McDowell, which is a good choice.
I mean,
Roddy
McDowell. I think it'd be a little too on the nose to have Vincent, though. I think it would be
true.
It wouldn't be as original. I like the fact too that they gave it like an OC character, original character, for that. So it's definitely benefits, and also gives it more structure to actually have new thing and something new to go with.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It would have been distracting to see Vincent Price.
Right.
Yeah, because he brings so much with him that you want to evoke him, but you don't want him necessarily.
Exactly. So we actually have someone that actually commented, Castler Daniel Garcia said, glad that the original ending of Peter Vincent turning into a vampire was changed. Yeah, I'm glad that they didn't deal with that. I think it's better suited with it having that happy ending and stuff like that. I think that it works that way, just in case they ever decided, hey, look, we want to have him back in here again for a sequel to follow up. And I don't like the other sequels that we had years after, but if they were going to try and do another sequel, whatever, and stuff like that, what better way to have it than to have that character come back instead of having to kill, Charlie having to kill him. Mm-hmm. Love Fright Night comic since Evil Ed Returns. Mm-hmm. The dance club scene is epic. Yes. It kind of reminds me of the Terminator, if you think about it.
Yeah.
That scene, every single time I think of that scene, I think of Terminator every single time.
The weird thing that came to my head, I know this is like, they're not even in comparison, but John Wick. So John Wick has the club scene, right? That is an epic, epic scene in that movie, right? And this one, I think, if I know it's not quite as epic as John Wick, but in comparison, it is. It's very much so like that, where all this stuff is happening. You know, it's not got the visceral nature of John Wick or anything, but, you know, it kind of evokes that kind of stylistic choices and so forth that happened in there, where you have these people interacting in a crowded place and stuff's happening, you know?
Right.
It really was interesting. And it was very well done. I didn't even recall when I was watching, I didn't even recall that scene, which I should have, because I thought it was really good.
That scene always stands out to me when I think of Fright Night, because of the fact of that suspense, how much suspense it is to that scene. Because with Terminator, you have him going after, basically going after Sarah Connor. This one, he's going after, you have another main antagonist going after Amy, which is another female lead. Right. So I just thought it was interesting on how they set that up for the nightclub scene for Fright Night. And it's also very scary to actually have this man, Jerry, trying to go after you as well. But yeah, Vincent accidentally discovers Jerry's true nature after glancing his lack of reflection in his pocket mirror, which causes him to accidentally drop and smash the mirror. With this terrifying knowledge, Peter flees, but Jerry learns of Peter's discovery after finding a piece of his pocket mirror on the floor. Amy comes to believe that Dinridge is a vampire, but Evil is not convinced and wants to hear nothing about it. As he leaves, he takes a dark alley, only to encounter Dinridge. He tries to run, scared, but Dinridge keeps up and bites him, changing him into a vampire. But I like how he messes with the alleyway and how narrow it is. And it reminds me of Nightmare on Elm Street in so many ways, because you're thinking that, okay, good, I'm fine, that's just fog and everything's good. But he also is playing with your mind, doing mind manipulation, because of the fact the walls are closing in on you. And you're in this little small space, and then next thing you know, and he bites you. But the thing that he tells him is, get up, Evil. I can help you. You've been bullied. You've been, you know what I'm saying? You've been bullied all your life. I can help you with that. And for me, I wanted to see him being bullied, because you don't see him being bullied. You don't see him being picked on.
No.
So for me, I needed to see more of...
But he was annoying.
Yeah, he was that.
You could see it in your head. You're like, yeah, I could see that. He was a pretty annoying character, so yeah. But I see what you're saying. It would have been nice to have a little bit more, And it didn't have to be an overt scene. It could have been something like he's going to talk to Charlie and then something happens along the way, you know.
Or in the school hallways or something where somebody right. just pushes him down as he's walking and he's getting picked on as a nerd or something like mm-hmm. that and walk away. And yeah. then I'm like, okay, then you're selling me on a reason why he wants to wants him to do that, wants to make a deal with Jerry. But you're mm-hmm. not giving me anything to make me go on and saying, hey, look, I don't blame Evil for wanting to do that, even though he is being hypnotized in a sense. But at the same time, I don't really buy the fact he's being hypnotized. I think that he's really getting off his feet and actually taking this deal with Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That's how I'm seeing it. I just have a hard time of him being believe that he's being hypnotized by Jerry. So that's just yeah. my thoughts on it.
Yeah, and actually the Ed story takes a weird turn after this encounter.
Right. Daniel says the cop does not die in this film. No, right. he doesn't. He's only in there for one scene and that's it. Yeah. You don't see the cops anymore. There's people dying everywhere, but there's no...
yeah, he was kind of a throwaway in a little bit. I said right. early on, I said there wasn't that much throwaway. He was a throwaway because he comes in and, you know, tries to get involved and then he's out of there pretty quickly. So
right. Daniel also says Charlie's mother should have been in the scene. To be honest with you, I don't even remember anything about the sequels or anything like that because I think mm-hmm. Will Smith MIB'd me and made me forget about the sequels, and this is the only one that I know of. And the remake, of course.
Right. But I don't think I've never watched the sequel, so.
Me either. No. Well, I watched maybe about 15, 20 minutes of it, and then I think I shut it off. I don't remember.
I don't remember, much about that if I did, so.
But... yeah, we talked about the nightclub scene. We talked about now the dance scene between him, between Jerry and Amy was kind of cringy, but I understand where they're going for the whole sexualization of a vampire, right. seducing her, hypnotizing mm-hmm. her, and going after her. Just as Sarah Connor is being chased down by Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator and trying to get away from him, she's mm-hmm. also trying to get away from Jerry. So right. that's
right.
I'm just trying to. It's just like how I'm seeing this club scene. You know what I mean? I'm not saying mm-hmm. that it's shared universe. I'm sorry if I'm using anybody, but it's just how iconic it is for me to see that.
Right.
But you know, and then you see this other part where she's looking in the mirror, she's dancing by herself, twirling by herself. She's coming to her senses a little bit, but Jerry just keeps on twirling her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even buy the fact that she's even hypnotized. There's just something about it. They don't put no music or anything like that to show she's being hypnotized
right.
or anything. It's like, oh, Jerry's here. Okay, I'll go to Jerry. And she goes to Jerry. And then Jerry goes on ahead and they start dancing and having this over-sexualization of this dance. And then he pulls up her skirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, whoa, I don't remember that as a kid.
They might have cut that out on Comedy Central or something. I don't know.
I don't even know if this would be a comedy at this time. My wife turned to me. She goes, you know, this is like softcore porn. I was like, be quiet. I'm watching the movie.
Really? She said softcore porn? Really?
She's like, She's like, this is like equivalent to like watching a porn because it's like NC-17 at that time for 80s movies. I was like,
right.
Well, but still, I'm like, it's the 80s. I just shrugged it off.
Yeah. I think my wife was watching with me, and I think she was commenting on, you know, the age gap.
Yeah, there was.
Which the funny thing was, in reality, there wasn't much of an age gap, but the portrayal is the age gap was much bigger. You know what I mean? She was underage, so.
Right.
But not in reality. But and you know, I'm like, that's all. I'm like, well. He's a vampire, you know. Think about Twilight. There's an age gap.
He's a vampire. He can get away with it.
He can get away with it.
Because, of course, there's going to be an age gap because he is a vampire. You're talking about someone that's over 500,000 years old.
Right. He's a vampire.
You know.
But it's funny when you look back, you know, through time at these things and how, you know, back then didn't bat an eye. But now you're like, because this brings up something else to mind is the age gap between Marion and Indiana Jones was set up that Marion was very young compared to Indiana Jones. And no one really thought about that at the time, but, you know, and we don't talk about that now, you know, because they change. It's Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark instead of just Raiders of the Lost Ark. But anyway, the you know, there was an age gap, and it was more normalized in that time period than it is now. Now it would not be something that they would bring to the screen as readily.
Right. So now. We got, and then after that, we have, after that winds up happening, we have this whole entire deal now where now Charlie has to try and get Amy back.
Mm-hmm.
And so back at his house, Benson is scared and tries to shake off his feeling of dread. Just then, Ed knocks on the door, on his door, claiming that there's a vampire out there. Benson lets him in, and Ed reveals that he's now a vampire. He then attacks Benson, who narrowly escapes by injuring him with a cross. Ed slinks away, threatening Vincent with telling the master. Meanwhile, Jerry chases Charlie and Amy into a nightclub. While Charlie is trying to call Peter for help, Jerry hypnotizes and abducts Amy, who bears a resemblance to Jerry's lost love, with the nowhere left to turn. Charlie attempts to gain Peter's help once more. And at this point, this is when he knows that, look, there's a chance that he'll help me, and there's a chance that he won't, because he took money last time. This time he has a
right. So yeah, will he help out? Yeah, with his box of goodies,
right, with his little stakes and his other vampire hunting gear that he has. Peter's still frightened from having dealt with a vampire. Ed initially refuses, but then resumes his vampire killer role. As Charlie approaches his neighbor's house, the two are able to repel Jerry's attack using crucifixes through only Charlie's work. Since he has faith in the spiritual power, Billy Cole, Jerry lives at a carpenter in daytime protector, appears and knocks Charlie over the banister and onto the ground. Peter flees to Charlie's house, finding that Mrs. Brewster is at work, no surprise, and is attacked by evil Ed, who is
working nights.
Take the wolf form.
Right. That was the puzzling thing to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I was even puzzled by that too, because I forgot about the whole wolf thing.
Right.
So I was thinking, okay, was this his bodyguard? It made more sense. Because remember, he even asked Vincent, he goes, wait, you have a gun? He goes, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah.
So they could have easily let the bodyguard be the wolf man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and do it that way. That way you have two different legends going on. You have the wolf man aspect, right, the wolf aspect to it, and you also have the vampire aspect of it. And have people kind of like Monster Squad.
Right, sense. Monster Squad, yeah, exactly. They just need a Frankenstein in there, and you've got the team.
No, we won't go that far, but I will say, I think it made more sense because Vincent had the gun to take down the wolf because of the bullets. So
right.
It made more sense. Just to have, I think I felt like that at that moment, they didn't know what to do with Ed. So it's like,
right,
okay, at this point, he's just a throwaway character. What do we do with him? Let's transform into a wolf. But isn't that what Dracula does? It doesn't matter. We just want to get rid of him.
Right. He's right. We've run it. Unlike the cop who was dropped, we got to run him out in a spectacular way. Yeah. But why was it? Because he was a wolf, though. And it's like, well, how did he become a wolf?
Right.
Does Jerry have the power to make him a werewolf?
I would think that he would make his own self a werewolf versus somebody else a werewolf.
Yeah, I don't know. It kind of came out of nowhere there. It worked for me because at first, I mean, he's got kind of kind of Evil Ed has kind of scraggly teeth to begin with, and so then his vampire teeth are scraggly, but then it turns out that he was a wolf, and it's like, wait a minute. But we went with it, right? When you're watching the movie, you go with it. But upon thinking about it for a minute, you're like, how, you know, did he have like a, did Jerry give him a syringe full of something to make him a werewolf? Or, you know, why all of a sudden the werewolf?
Right. And all of a sudden now Jerry the werewolf.
It didn't track with everything. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it was cool and they did a good job of it, but. As far as the effects go, and that's one of the things in this movie. I mean, we haven't really been into the effects heavy part yet, but this was one of the first effects heavy parts, right? And in the Ed effects for the time were great.
Right.
I mean, you look at it now, you know, but if you think about the time period, this they really went all out for the effects in this movie.
The effects are awesome. The transformation of the werewolf and slow process of the werewolf transformation was really good. I really have to say, I definitely liked it how they go back into human form. And, you know, at that point, too, he got stabbed inside. You know, he gets stabbed with a wooden stake, but it's not considered a wooden stake because it was just a banister that got that Peter winds up stabbing him with. And then you realize, oh, crap, it's actually, because I was thinking it might be the bodyguard, because it's been so long since I've seen this movie. I'm like, oh, it's evil. That does not make sense, but it's evil.
It's evil.
And it's evil. And then his little cross gets erased and he's a human form. And I'm like, okay, cool story, bro. Okay, sorry that you died. But
It was weird.
It was. I felt that was something that I didn't really care for.
And I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but the mom was gone and he goes up to check on the mother and then it's Ed the wolf. So it's kind of a big bad wolf scenario gets thrown into it here because the big bad wolf, you know, was in the bed of the grandma or whatever. But anyway, it's just kind of weird. Maybe that's why they went that way. I don't know. But it is a little incongruous with the rest of the movie, but they did such a good job of it, of that whole interaction and the effects and everything, that you kind of just go with it. And you don't even realize, afterwards you realize it, and then you're like, well, whatever, we're on to the next thing.
Right. And then, of course, this is going to be where they're going to try and wrap everything up, too. But yet, then at this point, you know, Charlie's unconscious. Charlie is then taken away to Amy, who has been turned into a vampire by Jerry. Peter says the process can be reversed, but only if they kill Jerry before dawn. Right. But I also like how now he's now face to face with Amy, and Jerry's just glutton there. It's like, you might need this. There's the steak that he made.
Right.
And he goes, and then all of a sudden he's like, no, because he winds up finding out that Amy is now bitten by Jerry, who now is going to turn into a vampire.
Right.
And then you have Vincent coming in there, and Jerry's back downstairs with his little dude, his friend. And you know, and then I like how Vincent is just quickly there to take down this door, this little old man. Might as well get Dr. Loomis to go ahead and and bang down this door with you, because that door would not have opened with that one dude.
No. But you know, exactly. But he got it open. They hadn't finished the restoration yet. That was the deal. We're still working on that, you know.
Right, and
in the house. Like, so that door was weak because it hadn't been refinished.
What it is, it's just filled with termites. It was easy to bust open.
Termite damage, exactly.
Right, termite damage. You know, no one's back there or anything. Fine for a vampire to move in. Vampire safe.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, I liked how, you know, he was telling Charlie, hey, look, make some noise, act like that there's something going on, and I'm gonna try and bust this door open. I'm like, okay, you're screaming and you mean to tell me this vampire cannot hear that there's another man that's trying to bust this door open?
Well, he's got good hearing as well, right?
Right, exactly. That's But then Charlie and Peter are confronted by Billy, whom Peter shoots on the assumption that Billy is human due to having a reflection and appearing during the daytime. However, this only proves that he is not a vampire, not that he is human. Billy rises again and is only killed when hit through the heart by Charlie, dissolving him into goo and dust. Charlie appears, but Peter is able... Right. This is something I don't get. Is he a zombie?
Again, it's like the wolf thing. They don't really go explaining it. He's another entity of some sort.
I understand you're enslaved to him because it's like Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Renfield, yeah.
Right. Like him, like Renfield.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make any sense, though, for them to shoot him and he's not dying. The way they do the effects, I'm like, so this guy's been traveling with him all this time. Is he a zombie? What's going on with him? They don't give us much into that either.
No, but again, it was super cool.
Right, it was. It was super cool.
When it happened.
My mom's like, that's a little over the top. I'm like, yeah, Nickelodeon would probably approve this, though.
Yeah, they would, I think. They'd be like, on brand. But the effects were so cool and everything kind of happened and you're like, wow, you know what I mean? You're blown away by the spectacle, just like you were with Evil Ed in his situation.
Right. Right.
So much that you didn't care about what was that. You know, all the questioning comes later. At the time, you're like, oh my gosh, what is he? He's not a vampire. He's not human. What is he? And then he just turns into this thing of goo with bones flopping out of it. And you're like, wow, that was super cool.
You know? I want to see it again. Let's rewind it.
That's right. Rewind it. Exactly. Because it was. I was like, and I don't think, even at that time, for sure, no one had probably seen anything like that at the movies. And this is where, I guess I'll bring it up now. So this is where we get into... we talked about it. It's Hitchcockian. It's a comedy. It's this. It's that. And this is where we get into 80s gore. So if you think about movies like The Thing, right, and American Werewolf in London was a little earlier than that, but American Werewolf in London. And this is when special effects, makeup effects, and so forth were really pushing the envelope. And this did at the time. You know, this was really something to see. That you weren't seeing anywhere, you know, and the gore factor of it was a bit high because we said it was a little bit much. Yeah, it was a little bit much. But that I think was part of the point of the movie because it was kind of following the trends that was going to be a little bit much.
Right.
You mentioned Terminator, like Terminator cutting his eye out, you know, stuff like that.
Right. So, cut his eye out and also his arm. Yeah, it felt Terminator was more like a horror movie than a sci-fi movie,
right?
As well,
yeah.
By the way, you guys can listen to that review on the podcast as well, including the Shaun of the Dead episode and Night of the Living Dead. Just throwing that out there for a couple of people that want to listen to the audio podcast as well.
Yeah,
but yeah.
It was trending at the time, I suppose, and they really did a fantastic job. I read. Up a little bit and basically the one of the largest parts of the budget was for these effects. So they didn't pay a huge amount of money for, Charlie, Amy and everybody. They paid the money in the effects. So
you can definitely see it in the effects, and the effects are not just for the sake of having the effects. It actually amplifies the experience and the shock value of seeing what Charlie is seeing as well.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be honest with you. The way that Amy looks, she looked hot. I'm like, okay, I wouldn't mind you being a vampire.
Right. Charlie was like, wait a minute. I'm glad I waited. No, just joking.
Now we can wait an eternity.
Yeah. No, this is better. This is even better than on the floor. Come on.
You know what else, though? Forever, there'll be virgins, and therefore they can keep forever.
Forever.
All right.
Yeah, so they super, sexualized her when she turned into the vampire, right?
Right.
So she was a cute 80s girl before. Now,
Right.
Something else entirely. Yes.
So now we have, finally, we actually have this happening now. So Billy rises again, is only killed when staked through the heart by Charlie, dissolving him into goo, like we said. Jerry appears, but Peter is able to lure the overconfident vampire in front of a window using a crucifix, which now works against Jerry in the hands of Peter due to his renewed faith in his abilities. Just before the morning sunlight comes ablaze, Jerry turns into a vampire and attacks Peter and Charlie before fleeing wounded into his coffin in the basement. Charlie and Peter go in pursuit of Jerry. Peter breaks open Jerry's coffin and tries to stake him through the heart. While Charlie has to fight off Amy, her transformation by breaking the back window of the basement. Peter and Charlie are able to expose Jerry to the sunlight and kill him. Jerry's death leads Amy to become human again, and the three embrace and hug.
Yeah. This scene, though, I thought was really quite good with the way that they built it up, right? So with the sunlight, because all the windows have been painted black by Billy the goo guy and slime man.
Right.
And they went around and they started busting the windows at first accidentally, I think, initially, and then eventually on purpose. And it really was, it really made for, I think, a finale that worked really well for this movie to get it. So, you know, and thankfully, and this is one of my pet peeves, is we had an ending as opposed to several endings, which is what a lot of times we get nowadays, where, you know, he gets away or something and then they have to go find him again. This was it. You know, the showdown happened in the basement and they started busting these windows and so forth. And it really felt, you know, it built the tension. Are they going to get him? Right. I mean, you know, they get him because of the movie. But anyway, it did build the tension a bit more, I think, the way that they did it with all the breaking of the windows and letting in the light.
Agreed. I definitely agree with you. The breaking of the windows was very smart. Trying to get him lured in back into the basement and then him having to take him down and then stake him. I love that aspect of it. The only thing that didn't sell me was Vincent does not have any faith to actually have the crucifix. All of a sudden, Jerry's flapping and goes, hi, you need to have faith in order to use the crucifix. All of a sudden, he smiles and holds the crucifix and now he has faith. I'm like, that was
change your heart. Yeah.
And I'm like,
well, least, you know,
I wish it was like some line of thinking or like a
God works in mysterious ways.
Okay, Elwood. Elwood. You want to go see the penguin? I just wish it was like a little bit of narration or something in his head of what was going on at that moment.
Yeah, but I think that's part of what we're talking about it afterwards, all these things come into your head. But while you're watching it, everything moves forward. And so I think they stripped out a lot of that kind of stuff to where you don't need it. And you don't need it while you're watching it. Afterwards, you're like, wait a minute. Why the werewolf? Why this? Why that? But while you're watching it, you're like, it pretty much smoothly travels through the story and you get there, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. So Travis Mitchell says, one of my favorite pieces of trivia is Roddy McDowell didn't like how over the top Stephen Jeffries was taking Evil Ed. So his dinners in the oven bit is so big was to piss him off. I like that. That's actually pretty funny.
Yeah. That's funny.
But you know, like you said, we don't question anything until after we see it. Just like how I wonder in The Lost Boys how Max was able to get into the house at the climax of it whenever he was never invited in the in the first place. Oh, well, no, not Max. But when you have the other Lost Boys busting into their house, they were never invited in. It was just Max that was invited in. So I was always questioning why did that happen? But, you know, I even tried Googling. Nothing came up.
Right. She's editing for the plot to move forward. It had to happen, but
right.
Right. But you get swept up in the story. I mean, so many times with in your own life, you get swept up in what's happening and you forget about the details. And so, you know, I think it works, but I think it worked well for this movie to keep everything moving and not to be, you know, so critical of things to stop the flow of the story.
Right. And that's something that I really liked was the flow of it. And we mentioned the runtime of it being an hour and 42 minutes, and you don't even feel a runtime at all for this movie because how quickly paced it was. I always thought it was like really slowly developing the characters, a little bit of Charlie. I thought it was like a day or two later that the neighbor moves in. No, it's that same night that he's trying to get lucky. But, you know, I definitely like I mentioned before, I liked how they winded up trying to take Jerry down in the basement and stuff like that. And then finally, he winds up, Peter winds up staking him. And then he brings him into the sunlight and fries him. And then after that, everything's good with him and Amy, with Charlie and Amy.
Right.
So I like the climax of it. I think the climax works. I like how things are not rushed when it comes down to the climax. Because I feel like movies today are too rushed to get it over with. And this one, you have...
Some have three endings.
Right. You're right. It has three endings.
Yeah.
Let's see here. We actually have something that Travis Mitchell said with the underground lair they had in Lost Boys. They easily could have said the foundation of the house was built on top of it. So they don't need any invitation. That would actually be make smart. I like that idea.
But the head vampire wanted to be invited in. And so then that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but he was not a lost boy. It would be like the lost man. So therefore.
Okay. Different, whole different movie. Lost.
Right. Man. He's trying to find himself after all these years.
Could I get an invite to come in? Yeah.
I've been trying.
I'm a gentleman. These kids are ruffians.
Right. Exactly.
Boys.
These boys need a parent.
That's right.
All right. So a few nights later, Peter returns to his Fright Night gig and announces a break from vampires. After, like, right. I want to know how long he was on TV and decided, hey, I want to retire.
Yeah.
Instead of selecting to be present in an alien invasion movie, watched in Charlie's bedroom by Charlie and Amy, the last shot shows two red eyes appearing from the darkness of Jerry's house and Ed's voice laughing and saying, "Oh, you're so cool, Brewster."
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
So now this, we're going to loop back here. So the last scene is Charlie and Amy. And where are they at in the bedroom at this point?
Okay. Now this is what I want you to talk about, because you said we're going to put a pin where we were before. Okay. Go on ahead.
So in the beginning, they were on the floor beside the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And all this happens, and now when they get back together again, they're on the bed, okay? And again, this I know this reads in. This is mise-en-scene, right? So when they're off the bed, that's teenagers fooling around, and now they've endured this, and so now they've gone to the next level. Now they're basically, you know, trial by fire. We're adults. We're going to be on the bed and fooling.
And mom's going to be a grandparent.
Yeah, and then they're going to get married. Yeah, so that is a weird little tiny detail. He could have had him on the bed at the beginning, but he didn't, because they were hiding, right? They were beside the bed,
right,
away from the door, hiding and trying to get away with something. And now, you know, we've been through so much. We don't need to hide anything. And that is that's a progression, right? So that's an interesting progression between the characters from the beginning to the end. And it's so subtle, right? But I know it had to be intentional, because the easy thing to do would have been, because, you know, movies aren't shot in order, is to shoot all the scenes beside the bed on the same day and have them. Mm-hmm. The beginning and the ending shot in the same day with different clothes, and they had everything set up. But no, they took the time to move everything, you know, to put them on the bed. So that's intention, being intentional with their thing,
attention to detail.
Right. Yeah, but there's a lot of details in this movie, and I think that's also, besides the fact that the pace is fantastic and so forth, is there's so many of these kind of little details, the pencil, and you know, this move to the bed, and all this kind of, you know, the Peter Vincent having his kit from when he was an actor, you know, all these little details that really bring this movie up, is because it's subconscious, right? So you're not, you know, thinking about these things while you're watching the movie, but it all adds to the movie. And I think that's really what makes this hold up over time, is the fact that they really took the time to put a lot of these little weird details. Somebody in the chat talked about eating fruit.
Yeah. And, talking about the Lost Boys as two of the most annoying cliches. A villain eating fruit and people not finishing food, taking a bite and throwing it. Right, and then Travis also mentions my take on Peter and Peter having faith in his whole life is him embodying characters who believe and do things. He knows how to be a hero and how one would think, but isn't. When himself. Okay, I like that idea. Yeah. I like that idea. Thank you for that deep thought on that. I didn't think about that.
And he didn't take money for the second turn, right? So he took
Exactly. Dude, we had bills he had to pay, right? So he was like, okay, I'm gonna take $500 from these miners. They're not gonna miss it. That's just the lunch money. That's they can starve for the whole year of school, and that's also part of the college fund.
Yeah. Exactly. But then the second time he didn't. For lack of a better term, he manned up and he went in and helped and saved the day.
Right. And then after that, he charged. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, he went back. He got his gig back. And we don't even know how that happened, but he got his gig back, which was fantastic. And he was back on doing other stuff.
Exactly. So Travis also says the ending with the cross. I see him not having faith, but having skills to embody a person who does having chose to be something instead of
He's not. He's not a part anymore of a vampire hunter. Now he is a vampire hunter.
Right.
Exactly. That makes sense.
He's embodying who he is. Right.
He got his confidence.
What better way than to actually hunt a vampire and gain confidence? Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. That's a man right there.
You do exactly. You're not gonna catch any fish until you go fishing. So.
Exactly. So my question for you, Bob, is this. Okay, now that we stripped away the nostalgia, now that we talked about the scene by scene, what would you give this out of 10?
So I totally agree with your 8 out of 10 assessment early on.
The nostalgia.
So,
right.
With the nostalgia factor on it. Definitely 8 out of 10. I would say at least a 5, maybe somewhere between 5 and 6. I don't want to quite say 6. But between 5 and 6, because, time marches on, right? And so there's other, other things have happened in the interim that make movies more interesting than this one. But I think because of a lot of things, it still holds up. So it's not like, way down low, but not certainly doesn't hold the 8 that it would have back in the day.
Exactly. So I'm actually going to give this a 6 as well, because that's actually what I was going with, was like either a 5.6 or a 6 itself. So I'm going to go with a 6 because of the fact that, yeah, there are some questionable things in this movie, but there are some things that you can enjoy and just watch it and still be able to enjoy some of the nostalgic stuff with it. But stripping it away, there's some stuff that doesn't fit in. But still, I had fun watching it. I'm glad I rewatched it. But my question for you, Travis, is this, okay? So what would you rate this as a non-nostalgic review, as stripping it away? And what would you rate it as a nostalgic? And also, too, for you, Blood and Bruise, what do you rate this as a nostalgic review, as best out of 10? And also, stripping away the nostalgia. So top 10 vampire flicks. I like the fact that you said that, Blood and Bruise. Because I actually enjoy watching this on Halloween or whenever it's on. I always find a way to actually watch this movie. But yeah, that's going to be it as far as this goes. But if you guys can, tell me what your favorite vampire... 7.5. Okay, that's pretty good. 7.5. That's pretty high. Okay. That's pretty cool, man. I'm glad that you chose that. That's actually your rating. That's actually pretty cool. It's one of the... Okay, so Travis says, it's one of those movies where they stop explaining things as craziness starts to ensure. But probably a 7 out of 10. Okay. Evil Ed's transformation.
I love the Evil Ed transformation. it's very
come
good.
On.
Very good.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know what? We like the transformation. Bob and I both talked about the transformation. We both loved it. We both like that. So, yeah, we're glad that you guys enjoy this as much as we do. But, yeah, I'll be back. As a matter of fact, I just want to mention this. I'm going to have Richard Elfman, Danny Elfman's brother, is going to be here coming up let's see here. We'll look at my notes. Well, I'll make this right. Because I was messaging Anastasia today because we had to change up the days because of the fact that we're doing our Penguin reviews on Wednesday, right? So I had to switch everything around and finagle it around, right? So this is how we did it. So basically, he'll be here on the 15th, which is a Tuesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 8 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time. Then Anastasia will be here. His wife will be here on Thursday on 10:10 at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And this is actually the brother of Danny Elfman. And yeah, so go on ahead, check that out if you guys can. We'd be glad to go on ahead and have you guys back here again for that. And of course, our Penguin reviews are going to be on Wednesday nights, 8 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Let's see, Travis says, it's interesting how they wanted Evil Ed back for the sequel, but it didn't happen. So they brought him back in the original comics and the new comics from this year. There's a podcast sequel written by Tom Holland with the most of the original cast coming out this year, which I'm excited for. Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Travis says, sounds like a fun time. I need a copy of the sequel. I've been able to find one. Yeah, they might have it on eBay. I'm not sure if they still print it. It's still printable or not. But, you know, but if you guys want to, go on ahead. If there's a movie that you want me to review or anything like that, just email me at movielovesunite@gmail.com. This is, of course, a spooky season. So if you want me to review a spooky movie, just go on ahead, email me at movielovesunite@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate us over there on Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your podcasts from. And, of course, go on ahead and follow me on Spotify as well. We'll be able to talk back and forth. If you still want to geek out with me after the show, email me as well. So yeah, and then Blood and Bruce says it's like finding a unicorn. Haven't been able to find one. The sequel is free to watch on YouTube because it's public domain. Haha. The sadness.
Right.
So thank you, Blood and Bruce, for joining me. I know it was like the last few minutes that you came and joined, but thank you so much for that, Travis. Thank you for commenting as well. I do appreciate it. I also want to go on ahead. There's somebody else that was in the chat earlier. I want to thank Daniel as well for commenting in the comment section as well. Thank you so much. You guys are the reason why I do this live. So go on ahead, smash the like button, smash the subscribe button. Don't forget to visit Bob as well. Go on ahead, visit Bob's podcast. Tell him the name of your podcast.
Oh, staticradio.com. You can go there. We actually do live as well on Monday nights, and you can go to I think it's staticradio.com/live. It'll take you there. So okay. You can do that. A couple of things. You mentioned Back to School.
Yeah.
Danny Elfman, Oingo Boingo, highlighted in Back to School, by the way. Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then I'll pitch an idea. So Salem's Lot is an old horror movie, Stephen King book that was made into a horror movie back in the late 70s. And the sequel just came out today.
A matter of fact, I might actually do a panel
a sequel,
show.
A remake. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a remake. A matter of fact, I'm actually thinking about doing a panel show for the remake. So if you want to join me for that, you're more than welcome.
I watched most of it tonight before this.
So you're already prepping already, Bob. This is why.
Well, I wanted to watch it. It's great. It was a good. Salem's Lot scared the crap out of me as a child. So my wife was like, we have to watch it. I'm like, I'm going to be scared. And I am still tonight. This is going to be a terrible night for me, folks.
Terrible, but good night for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to be probably watching it sometime this weekend. because I love Vampire.
I would recommend it. I didn't get to the end because I wanted to be on time for you, but yeah, it is. They do a pretty good job of it, I will say.
Okay. Lots of options on those. Just watched that last night. Okay. By the way, I did do a review of the original Salem's Lot on the podcast as well. And it's also on the YouTube channel as well, too, if you want to check that out for the original one. But I am planning on doing like a panel show for the remake. So, guys, that's going to be as far as the show goes. Don't forget to smash that like button, smash that subscribe button, visit Bob over at Static Radio. And everyone have a great and safe night. Thank you again, everyone in the comment section. You guys are wonderful. Have a great and safe night, and we are out. Bye, guys.
Later.